Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for Biz Rocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. This is John Baker with my partner, Stone Payton. Stone, how are things going this morning after a nice chilly week, but no snow, no ice? Last time we were here, we were crazy ice storm and all that stuff.
Yeah, I know. The snowmageddon and all that. Things are crazy. I walked out of the house this morning without a coat, though, and it is awfully chilly outside. But in answer to your question, I am fired up. I don't know if you've gotten word or not, but we're going to have, probably in a matter of a few weeks, certainly no more than a month or two, we are building out Radio X Lounge.
Really?
Yeah, both here and the Glen Lake studio. And so we are actively seeking sponsors, people to sponsor the lounge in general, but also to sponsor the amenities. So the beverages, the food, the appliances, the art, the furniture.
Wow.
And we've already had quite a bit of very positive response. And part of the fallout from that is we did just acquire a major sponsor that you don't know about yet.
Yeah.
But you and I, we got to start getting some practice doing these live reads.
All right.
They're major sponsors, so it's the Business Marketing Association of Atlanta.
Nice.
Which I think we can also call BMA Atlanta. But at some point in the program, like once or twice in the program, you or I or both of us, you know, we have to say, you know, if you've just joined us, we've been visiting with Joe Smith, yada, yada, yada. This segment brought to you by BMA.
I can do that.
Okay,
I can
all right. So we could practice that on this
awesome.
Session if you
Look,
want.
You've been busy.
I have, man.
I'll leave you alone for 2 weeks, and you're out there creating stuff and making things happen in lounges. And
I'm very excited about the lounge thing.
Yeah.
I'm a lounge personality.
I can see that.
But you know
with
that
the lack of shave this morning.
Now, see, you didn't have to tell on me. The people
I know, they
cannot
can't
see that
know,
out there in radio land.
But Eves and Jack here, our guests, they can see you. So, you know, they know what's going on. All right. Well, let's get started. We got two great guests in this morning. Our first guest, Jack Shaw, is with Breakthrough Business Technologies. And Jack, well, we welcome you in today.
Thank you very much.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background and maybe through about Breakthrough.
Okay, that's great. I appreciate that. I have been fortunate to spend most of the last 30 years or so in my career working on the leading edge of technologies, from electronic funds transfer back in the 70s before the automated clearinghouse was even in existence, to electronic data interchange in the 1980s and the early days of e-commerce in the 90s. So I formed a company called Breakthrough Business Technologies just a few years ago, and what we do is we focus on helping both technology solution providers and end-user organizations understand and leverage emerging technologies for strategic advantage.
Well, that's great. And how long has your business been up and running?
Well, this particular business has been up and running for 2 years now,
mm-hmm.
but it also builds off a lot of work that I did in consulting for an earlier business that I had, e-commerce strategies, that was in place for about 18 years up until the early 2000s. I went back into the software business for a few years when I recognized that advanced intelligent systems and, in particular, decision management technologies were going to be emerging in the near future, and wanted to take advantage of the opportunity to get to understand those in depth.
Now, in your literature, you talk about decision management. Tell us more about what that is and how that works.
Well, decision management is one of four breakthroughs that all business people need to understand and be aware of, and at least have plans for how and when they're going to be adopting these technologies. Other breakthrough business practices and technologies include social media, mobile commerce, cloud computing, and, of course, decision management. Decision management itself is really a business practice, and it's about understanding in detail all of the routine operational decisions that are made in an organization and carefully managing the processes for making those decisions as effectively as possible.
Does that take how to make those decisions and wrap it into technology and kind of the IT world, or is it really completely separate from the technology side of things?
Well, the reason that decision management is emerging as a business practice so strongly now is that we have very powerful technologies that have come to the fore over the past few years that make it much easier to effectively understand and manage routine decisions, and in many cases automate those decisions, the result of which is that you end up with your day-to-day operational decisions being made more accurately, more consistently, faster, at lower cost, and more flexibly in response to changing business conditions.
So it's a process for making these decisions almost using technology.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And how does it differ from business intelligence in terms of how you would use those either together or separately to improve a business?
Well, that's an excellent question because there's a lot of confusion and the terms sound similar to one another. Business intelligence is actually backward-looking. Now, don't.
I thought he was going to say oxymoron.
Well, and I'm not suggesting that people who use business intelligence are backward thinking. That's not my point. But business intelligence looks at historical data and tries to determine whether there are trends in that data that may be able to be projected forward to help you make better decisions. Now, as far as it goes, business intelligence is very powerful technology, and it's technology that is really what I consider table stakes, to use a poker-playing term. It's sort of entry-level. You've got to be able to have that kind of historical data in your background to support the automation of routine operational decisions. The difference is that decision management, where most business intelligence technologies require people to be highly trained in statistical analytics and to use sophisticated tools and technologies to be able to ascertain the patterns that exist in historical data.
Right.
With operational decisions, you can't do that. You've got to have frontline people who are not trained statisticians that can interact with these systems, decisions not that are made in a matter of days or weeks using deep analysis, but decisions that are made in seconds.
Right.
And that are made quickly and effectively. And so consequently, decision management technologies leverage BI
right.
as part of their input, and then also draw on other data that's available in real time to either automate certain routine decisions, or at least to provide recommendations or parameters or constraints within which the people who are responsible for making those decisions should consider making those decisions.
Now, I know, I'm sure you've worked with many clients and all sorts of different examples of how that might work. Maybe you could pick out one example where you have gone into an organization and helped them with these two entities, business intelligence in helping kind of fuel the understanding of what's going on, and then the decision management actually making those decisions. Could you give us an example?
Yeah, let me give you an example from one of those without being specific as to the companies that were involved.
Of course.
No. We want to know. Tell on them. No, we get it.
So suppose you've got a situation where you've got a customer service representative in a call center, and she takes a call from a client, a prospective client, whose name she recognizes. Hi, this is John Smith from ABC Company, and I'd like to place an order for 2,000 cases of left-handed widgets. And she, the first thing she thinks is, ah, left-handed widgets, John Smith. I've heard talk about in meeting, this is a big deal, new client we've been trying to get for months and months, and here I'm the person getting the first order. And John says, but before I place the order, I need to know what delivery date can you commit to me? Now, business intelligence is going to give you a piece of that. But the right answer for her to give John Smith is not to say, well, Mr. Smith, you're going to be delighted to hear that we've got a business intelligence system. And in a matter of hours, we can run a statistical analytical survey that will tell you, based on both stock keeping unit and geographical location, the average delivery time for cases of left-handed widgets. You know, John Smith wants to know in the next half minute, am I going to get it Tuesday or a week from Friday?
Exactly.
Now, part of that is what is the average delivery time and where is he located and so forth. So you have to be able to have that historical data as input, but that needs to be input in real time. You have to have a system that also looks at things like what is your current production schedule, what's your available inventory on hand, and so forth. Now, in some cases, you may be able, based on the historical expertise of the people who know this area within the business better than anyone else, that the right basis for making this decision is based on factors 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
And therefore, there is only one correct answer, and that answer is on this specific date. You'll have it, next Thursday. Or, on the other hand, the system might come back and say, there are variables in play here. We need to allow a certain amount of flexibility and judgment on the part of this person, and it might come back and say, you can promise them any date between this Friday and next Tuesday. And that might be based on the fact that, given the available inventory, if you promise a date sooner than Friday, we're going to have to run an extra shift in order to make the stuff and get it there in time, and that's going to cost us more than the entire profits on the order.
Right, right.
On the other hand, it might factor in that history has shown us that any time that you have a delay of more than a week in filling the order, customers tend to cancel their old orders and go to alternative suppliers. So here's some parameters, and then you use your judgment and your knowledge of what else is going on to determine what you feel is an appropriate date within these guidelines. So that's a case where you're not automating the decision, but it's still a managed process because you're supporting the person's ability to make the best possible decision without removing the flexibility and judgment that needs to come into play in some cases.
Now, is this something that's applicable to, you know, pretty much any organization, or is this something that really is a good fit for a certain type or style or size of an organization?
The underlying principles of decision management affect any organization that needs to make routine operational decisions. Now, John, can you think of any organization that doesn't make routine operational decisions?
Well, probably not, but how about size? I mean, when you're dealing with larger or smaller organizations, you may have internal groups that deal with that, right? Or you might have such a small company that it's so tightly managed that they don't really need exact systems. Is that not the case?
Well, it's certainly the case in terms of how you apply technology.
Mm.
So if you've got a very small business and the CEO or one of maybe a handful of very experienced senior people are really involved in every routine day-to-day decision, then certainly there's no need to put sophisticated decision management technologies in place. When you get to this point where you have people working, as I consider it, on the front line, whether it's salespeople, customer service people, purchasing people, field service technicians, what have you, anybody who's out there, folks who are working on a manufacturing assembly line or a warehouse distribution operation, and they need to make decisions about whether it's how to fill an order, what's the best way to pack and ship, what is the best priority for servicing our customers, if we're out there like a field service technician, for example, whatever those might be. Very often those people are removed from the strategic perspective that senior executives have, and without some assistance and input, may not make the best decision from the perspective of the organization, given, say, what the decision that a senior executive might make, given his or her experience, knowledge, and understanding of the strategic objectives.
So it's almost a way to take that knowledge from senior management and kind of bring it down to the line workers so that they're making decisions that are much more in line with what the company wants them to do, instead of being off on their own, just kind of making decisions haphazardly.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I wouldn't use the word haphazardly, because, you know, in most cases, people are doing the best job they can with the information that's available.
Right.
But if what you can do, even without technology, if you can put together what's called a decision inventory, that is a method by which you identify what are the decisions that are made on a regular basis. Peter Drucker, the famous management guru, once said that it's a common mistake, but a serious mistake, to assume that only those decisions made by senior executives are important ones. You know, the three or four big decisions that the executives might make over the course of a year. What new markets are we going to enter? What companies are we going to acquire? Where are we going to build a new plant or partner up with a new organization, another organization? And those are important decisions. But for every decision that's made like that, first-line people are making hundreds or thousands of decisions every day or week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's through the effectiveness of those decisions that the actual execution of senior management strategy takes place. So it's important, as you put it so well, that those decisions be well-aligned with that strategy. So decision management as a business practice helps do that. If you can begin by identifying what those decisions are and what the parameters are for making those decisions effectively, even without technology, you're way ahead of the game. And then if you're large enough, which doesn't necessarily have to be very large, to incorporate technology and to support and aid in the management and, in many cases, the automation of those decisions, then you can be way ahead of the game.
So you've been in business for quite some time and obviously a professional for a while. What would you say are the kinds of things that you've seen businesses and business owners, whether it's in line with what you're doing now or just drawing from past experiences, that you've seen consistently within organizations that makes them successful? What would you say is a common characteristic or thread?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think one, probably the single thing that comes to mind more than anything else is the willingness to think strategically. You know, there's a very popular saying, think globally, act locally. And you can only act in the short term, you know, in the immediate present. But you've got to think about the long-term issues. And back at the height of the internet boom 10 or 12 years ago, I remember people saying, strategic planning is over. You know, nobody can plan more than 90 days in advance. And most of those were companies that were gone 180 days or 360 days later. So to me, I think that understanding where things are going, one of my favorite expressions of Bill Gates is that people constantly overestimate how quickly technology is going to change its impact on business in the short term and drastically underestimate how much it's going to impact business in the long term. And by long term, he means the 5 or 10 year time frame as opposed to the 1 or 2 year time frame.
Right. Right. So thinking out ahead of the curve is critical from what you've seen from a business success standpoint.
And I think that's the case whether you're talking about putting together your roadmap for incorporating technology into your business, which is the area that I focus on working with companies on, or whether you're thinking more generally about issues like how you're going to structure your organization, how you're going to market yourself, how your markets are going to change, how your products and services are going to evolve, and so forth.
What have you seen from a competitive standpoint? I mean, obviously, you're probably not the only, you know, dog in this hunt. You're more than likely, there's several organizations that do what you do.
Yeah, but they haven't been on Biz Rocket Radio.
That's true. So there's much.
It's apples not and
even
oranges.
It's not even a comparison. How would you say that your deliverable is competitively better, or how do you compete with the people that are out there in the same area that you're working in?
Well, you know, I don't really spend much time thinking about the people that I compete with. I spend a lot more time thinking about the competitors that my clients have to deal with and how to help them differentiate themselves and add more value to the solutions that they deliver. Yeah, I'm working in a field where things are constantly changing and emerging. There are a good number of folks in this field who have expertise in various different ways. I subscribe to a number of different RSS feeds and Twitter feeds and spend a good deal of time on top of it. I know that neither I nor any of these other folks are going to be experts in every aspect of all these rapidly evolving technologies. Instead, understanding how they can be applied and knowing where to go to find the right answers, you know, I think are the real keys. You know, that's what I try to do. That's how I try to differentiate myself and bring more value to the solutions that I and services that I can provide to my clients. And it's part of what I focus on in helping them try to do in their businesses.
Great. Well, that's good stuff. That's helpful for listeners to understand what the difference is between those two areas. It certainly makes sense. You got to know what the problem is, and you got to be able to have a structured way of making those decisions. It certainly seems to be a sensible practice. So if people need to get in contact with you, Jack, how would they reach out to you?
Well, probably the best way is to come to my website, www.ecom.com, and that's spelled with a hyphen, e-com.com. They can also follow me on Twitter at Jack Shaw.
Look at that, Twitter. You're using all those technology units, right?
Check me out on YouTube. I've got a number of videos on YouTube that folks are welcome to attend, and hopefully they'll enjoy viewing them from, I think, a minute and a half up to full hour-long presentations.
Wow.
And I've also got a blog, which is Business Technology Futurist on WordPress. And they're all linked to one another, so if they can grab any one of those places, they can find the links to the rest.
They can find all of the background.
Exactly.
Well, that's great. Thanks much, Jack, for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hopefully you can hang around a little bit for our discussion with Yves. You have a minute?
I absolutely do, and I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Well, our next guest is Yves Archambault, and Yves is with Bloom. Yves, how are you doing today?
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. I've seen Yves speak a few times there, Stone, and he's a pretty sharp cookie. We're going to set him up for success here. Hopefully he follows through. How's business with you?
Business is growing. Business is booming. The good news is I have the opportunity to work for a company that is growing, and we are recruiting. We are hiring technically. We are hiring for salespeople. So in a rough economy, it's a good place to be because we have growth where we are.
And tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing now.
Okay, so similar to Jack, I've been fortunate to work for leaders in the industry. So I've worked for the companies like IBM and Hewlett-Packard and Avanade, which is an Accenture company. So I've been fortunate in that sense. I've learned from some of the best and biggest organizations. In the last 30 years, my observation is that I remember too well the world where everything was proprietary. The hardware, the software, the services was one box, one big price, and the power was in the hands of the provider. And I've named those companies, and I've seen the birth of the PC, and that's in the 80s, and that brought separation. This is where hardware started to get separated from the software, started to get separated from the services, and started to give some power to the consumer or power to the buyer. What did we see after the 90s? The internet, right? And that brought some e-commerce, and it gave more power to the consumer, more power to the buyer. And then the next evolution is web services. In this past decade, the internet got smart. You know, we could do a lot of things on the internet, not just look at a website, but, you know, transact. And what's there now is the cloud, and everything is a service. I can start a company today and maybe buy just one laptop, one PC. Maybe that's all I need because everything is in the cloud. Everything is a service. You subscribe to it. Do I need to buy a lot of server hardware, software, and services? I don't. I can subscribe to a CRM instance from Salesforce or Microsoft. I can subscribe to Intuit and run my books. I can do all of this. So the power is shifted to the consumer side, the small enterprise side, And at Bloom, we want to help those companies grow by offering application services and build their business applications.
So, you know, we've heard this before. In the late 90s, we heard a lot of, oh, the internet and everything's going, nobody's going to be in businesses or buildings. Everything's going to be kind of interrelated on the computer, people working from home. That certainly seemed to take a lot longer than was first projected. So kind of two-part question on that. One is, why is it different this time? And the second is, why didn't it happen more quickly?
You know, why didn't it happen more quickly? I think there was a big shift at the time, and people were impressed. I must say also, I'm not a technologist, but the technology, the broadband was not exactly there. Things got much faster, much better. And I think technically we can do things right now that were impossible 10 years ago. We thought we had the technology. So there was a dream, there was a vision. I think Jack had a good quote on Bill Gates. You know, it took some time to bring all of this technology together. We needed things like open source, the Java world, you know, Microsoft standards. So things got standardized, things got commoditized and easier to deal with. So that's why I think we observe today an acceleration of web services and applications in the cloud. It's easier to do it today than 10 years ago.
So do you have a good John Baker quote, or we don't have one of those ready yet?
I'm working on that. Next time I'm invited, I'll have a John Baker quote.
Okay.
So you've dealt internationally and all around the world, I would imagine. What have you seen in terms of the United States' presence in the world economy? Is it something where we're losing our way? Are we on track from your vantage point?
Okay, so the naysayers or the negative-minded, I would say, would think we're losing our way. Remember in the 80s, we started to lose manufacturing to Japan? Car manufacturing shifted to Korea and Taiwan and even, you know, PC parts. We're still big? Are we still the biggest economy? We are. So we're innovating. You have to innovate your way out of an industry. I'm not suggesting we're out of manufacturing, but we're not the lion's king. You know, we don't have that sort of market share anymore. But look what we do here. We innovate in services industries, consulting. We design things. We invent things. So we need to do that because, you know, the U.S., 125 years ago, a rural agricultural economy, then the manufacturing economy. We live in a services economy. So we have to adapt. In countries like India, I've seen that. They seized the opportunity in the 90s, invested, good English speaking, invested in technology. They have graduated hundreds of thousands of software engineers and what we call the Indian Pure Play today, which are my competitor, have grabbed the technology, are now outsourcing. They're an avenue for outsource, they're an avenue to produce applications real quick. And I work for a Chinese company today that vies to compete with the Indian Pure Play. It's possible. The power is moving very fast around the planet due to technology, due to education. I think the U.S. is not losing its way. The U.S. needs to adapt its way into the next wave.
And the questions that we have on outsourcing, jobs being taken from the United States and going to China and going to India, how does that play a role in your vision of how and what the United States needs to do to be competitive?
Again, so it looks bad. You know, outsourcing doesn't sound good. We're losing jobs. We're losing, in the short term, a job to another country, to another person. And there are reasons for that. We lost manufacturing jobs. We're still a great country. We're still coming out of, you know, this recovery is starting to happen. So what we need to do is just adapt to the next wave. It's true that things that are simpler to do, which is producing applets or small apps, are moving to other countries. So as the U.S., look at what we're doing more. We're creating new ways of doing business, new ways of services. As a service, what do you think that was invented? It's invented here. Everything is a service. So there's new ways. For yourself, your radio station, you're not broadcasting in the air, right?
Right.
IP technology. And we can quickly replicate this show quickly on the internet. Tomorrow, Jack can use this and create maybe a podcast. You could not have done that 5-10 years ago. So I think it's a matter of adapting. It's a matter of adapting our services and create the next economy. Like, we created the PC economy. We created the computer economy. We created the internet e-commerce economy. What's next? How fun is that? Let's figure out what's next, and I think we just need to stay on top of that. There will always be a country right behind us trying to commoditize something, you know, commoditize the application services, commoditize a service. We just need to be good at that.
So the innovation of what's next is what...
innovation of what's next is the key.
All right. And what? Tell me more about Bloom and about what you guys do for organizations. I mean, if I'm a company, if I'm an organization, and I'm looking at hiring you guys, what would you be doing for us?
Thank you for the question. Bloom is an exciting place to work. Bloom is a growing, fast-growing, pre-IPO startup, a startup that is 10 years old. We have dozens of customers. And what we do is we build business applications. We build very complex, we solve complex problems for our customers. So a Bloom customer is a Fortune 100. A Bloom customer is a Fortune 1000. It's mostly a business. It can be a nonprofit, but think of it as large e-commerce companies. Think of it as a large financial services company in Wall Street. They need new applications. They need maintenance on their applications. I'm talking about complex, big business apps. We come in and we offer a very solid alternative to what we call today the IPPs, Indian Pure Plays. And some of these companies are also in the U.S., okay? We come in, we listen to the clients, and what we offer is an absolute quality play. We are standardized on CMMI Level 5. It stands for Capability Maturity Model by Carnegie Mellon. Level 5 is the highest level. We were the first outsourcing company in China to abide by this standard, and also ISO 27001, which is the highest level of information security. It's important when you're based in China to offer those standards. We bring this to the client, and we have a mantra. We have a DNA, and our mantra at Bloom is zero defect. People think it's utopia. It's our objective, thanks to our founder, Eric Wrongley. We approach the client, and we want to offer them the possibility of zero defect. We believe we have the best standard in the industry putting out applications that work on time, you know, delivered on time, delivered on budget. And we offer that in a Western-style management. Everyone at Bloom in China speaks in English during working hours. So that's what we offer. We're an excellent alternative to these Indian pure plays, and we're going to be very aggressive here in this market.
And how do you compete with those guys? I mean, what's the thing that separates you from your competition?
I'll tell you. People think that a Chinese-based outsourcer competes on price. That's not where we lead. We don't want to approach this place, and we don't want to say China's cheaper. One, it's not. It's about possibly the same price as an Indian pure play. And what we offer is to become a seamless extension to a development organization. We're not a project-based company where we do a small job for 3 months, you know, send me 3 Java guys and, you know, we'll code this app. We don't want to do that. We want to partner with clients, call it for life. We want a marriage. We want a relationship that will be measured in years, that will be measured in hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. We want to be the best application services partner to those clients. And our differentiation, John, is quality. We're going to offer the very best code quality, that zero defect mantra. We're going to bring this. We're going to give to the client the tools we use to manage our project, which is governance. And we have Hydra, which is sort of these executive dashboards that are available to our clients online real time.
I like that. That's nice.
Our competition cannot do that as effectively as we can do it. So we're very transparent. Super governance, and we bring the code quality. We manage on time and on budget. We try to do this, and I think we're very successful at it.
Now, do you have people on our shores executing some of this work as well, or is all the execution happening over there in China, or does it just depend on the situation?
That's an excellent question. We are heavy offshore. We want to do 90 to 95% of the work offshore. That application development, testing, QA, is done in Shanghai or Chengdu, and we will open different sites in Philippines, Vietnam, and eventually we're going to come near shore. Near shore would be like in Latin America. Onshore in the U.S. will be the on-site coordinator, a few maybe project managers or a business analyst. They come in early in the project to get things started. Who's left behind? At least one, maybe two, maybe three project managers, a senior business analyst, to continually work with the client to accumulate new requirements, but to manage. So in reality, tip of the iceberg, at the top, above level is the on-site team. Under the C-level is the offshore team in China. That's our model, and that's to help us keep to be price effective or cost effective.
And I would imagine you're doing a good bit of travel.
I do a lot of travel around the U.S. To continue answering your question, Stone, we have about 25 people in the U.S., so I have to travel around, meet customers. We have about 10 sales directors across the region, so that's our team. So I travel around the U.S. to meet clients, to go to conferences, and, you know, meet different people, and I've had the opportunity to go to Shanghai, China, about 2 times in the last 3 months to visit headquarters and to do some training and understand the business. So it's exciting.
Let's do a remote in Shanghai. You know, we're building our list. We got Lake Wadawi.
Yep. I think we already had Shenzhen, China. We're going to try and do that at Randy's.
So can we come
office.
To a remote in China sometime? Wouldn't that be fun?
You are invited to Bloom's headquarters in Shanghai.
All right. I like it.
So what has been your experience? I mean, obviously business is being globalized. There's probably 40% of the free world market is really U.S.-based, and the other 60%, for the most part, you're looking internationally. Are you finding that with your clients? Are you seeing a lot of your clients here in the U.S. still, or are they based all over the world?
Well, our clients are definitely based around the world. My responsibility is North America, but there's globalization everywhere. U.S. companies have offshored in many, many parts of the world. They have even opened captive centers. That means they open their own operation in other countries. And that's sort of a hybrid model. You know, we offer an outsource alternative to companies that have experience in India. They've opened a captive center. And what we want to offer is a better model where we can work with the client, allow them to keep their captive centers in India, but offshore some of the work to us in China, because maybe we're better at building a given application. So that's what we offer. So globalization is basically not to be worried about where the work takes place. I trust the clients will pick the right company, and if the best developers in the Philippines, more power to the Philippines. If the best designers are in the U.S., look at Apple. That's our power, and the power is shifting and is moving continually around. And EU adapts first, takes leadership role.
And have you found that to be companies in certain regions recently, or is it something that's just depends on the organization?
Well, no, countries, you have to look at countries. India invested a lot in the 90s, and look where they are today. You know, they're a major player in IT outsourcing. Now, the sleeping giant right now, and it's not sleeping, but it's awakening, is China. The Chinese government is investing billions of dollars in education in general. They are graduating in excess of 650,000 computer scientists every year. They're making English the second language in school. So they're very serious about, I don't want to say global domination, about global leadership. They're taking a major role in car manufacturing. They're taking a major role in IT technology in ways that 10 years ago nobody would have guessed them to pretend to the throne. And of course, they're behind India, but they're growing faster. So the action is moving east. It's moving to
that's
that
interesting
part.
That you say they're behind India. How do you mean?
Oh, in total, let's say, market share of IT spending.
Oh, okay.
IT investment. India created that place in the mid-90s. They're still...
But they're moving faster, so they're going to catch up and...
My prediction, in about 10 years, you'll see China, and as far as their place in the IT world, producing IT components, producing outsourcing services, software, you know, I can't predict they'll be at pace exactly with India, but they're growing faster, and one would guess that this is where they're aiming. They're aiming for the first position. Do you know any of athletes that compete for silver? They're training for silver?
No.
I think they all compete for gold.
That's a great point.
Aim for gold. Be okay with silver, I guess, right?
I guess they're not in the silver position yet, but that's where they're going.
Well,
they're going,
you know what? And to play out that entire analogy, if you've got a team in Detroit, you don't just look in Detroit for your talent. If the best guard in the country is in Florida, you go get them from Florida.
That's it.
Yeah. Oh, good stuff. One last question I had for you, and it's kind of something similar to what I asked Jack. if speaking to the audience out there and using your experience and the things that you've seen, people who are successful, people that have made it in the business world, what would you say to the audience as your pearl of wisdom of a characteristic or a trait that's important for somebody to be successful in business?
Okay. In business, specifically the world I'm in, IT, technology, okay. Yeah. Services. If I were a young person, less than 10 years experience, or college students, want to survive in this next economy, that next generation behind us, someone's going to have to be very, very good at something, at one thing or two things. There's not that much room for generalists, the general manager, the chief operating officers. There's very few of those positions. We need special teams, you know, the running back in football, right? Super Bowl weekend. You need to be very good. So you be the best developer, be the best tester, be the best quality testing designer, be the best chip design. Someone has to have a skill, hone the skill, and adopt it. It's okay in a career of 30 to 40 years to go from being an engineer, the best engineer you can be, to become a manager of engineers or to become a business manager. But in any segment of 5 or 10 years, you've got to be good at something. Because if you're not good at one thing, you're a generalist or you're going to be a low-wage worker.
That almost goes back to Henry Ford, right? Specialization, knowing how to do one thing really, really well and letting somebody else take the next step, and that whole process works out better than someone trying to do everything.
He commoditized manufacturing in mm-hmm. many ways.
Like Alan. Who knows more about sweaters than Alan, right?
Seriously. He is the sweater guy. Alan's got leather or deer or something on the top of that. We may have a...
From some exotic county in Norway.
Very exotic. It is. It's awesome. Well, thank you, Yves, for coming on the show. We appreciate your time. Maybe if people want to get in contact with you, what's the best way?
Well, if they want to talk about application services and software development lifecycle and what Bloom can do, they can visit. I'll give you my email and I'll give you our website. Our website is www.bloom. No, that's not Bloom like blooming. It's Bleum.com. So bloom.com. And my email address is myfirstname.mylastname@bloom.com.
You might want to spell that name.
Yves Archambault. Yves is Y, V as in Victor, E, S as in Sam, dot Archambault. Archambault is Archambault.
Yeah, yeah. Spell it just like it sounds. I don't understand right? The problem.
Well, I'm not a spelling bee champion, if you hadn't noticed. But
anyhow.
That's excellent. Well, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yves and Jack, we appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much.
Hopefully you guys can stick around for a little bit, and maybe we'll have you back in a few months and catch up and see how things are going.
We're going to retire to the Bloom / Jack Shaw Radio X Lounge.
That's right, the lounge, which is sponsored by...
Jack Shaw and Bloom today.
All right, well, until next week, stay safe.
Thank you.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. We'll be right back.